We've been hearing a lot about climate change lately, and this morning we look at the issue as it relates to migration of Pacific Islands and the health of its inhabitants. We sat down with Laura Brewington, who's a research fellow with the East-West Center, to talk about a $500,000 grant that it secured to do just that.
So the East-West Center has had a climate change adaptation program for a number of years now, and we have a variety of different sources of funding for the work that we do. All of it is focused on climate change and adaptation, and it's located here in Hawaii as well as in the U.S.-affiliated Pacific Islands. So this particular project is actually building off of work that we've been doing already in the USAPI looking at climate change and human migration, which has become a hot topic lately in the climate arena. There's a lot of images that you see of Pacific Islands, you know, that looks like they're sinking as the sea levels are rising. It's very dramatic. And so there are a lot of questions, specifically in the international arenas. Is climate change really causing people to migrate? And if so, you know, what are the mechanisms for migration? And here in Hawaii and the U.S.-affiliated Pacific Islands, we have a very unique framework for migration because of the Compact of Free Association, which allows residents and citizens of countries like the Marshall Islands to move freely to the U.S., to Hawaii, as well as the mainland, where they can be employed, they can receive health care, they're allowed to serve in the military, and they can also pursue educational opportunities. And so what we're seeing, and what we have seen for quite some time, is that members of these compact states, which include places like Palau, the Marshall Islands, the Federated States of Micronesia, and others, we're seeing people coming to Hawaii or the U.S. mainland for a multitude of different reasons. And the question that sort of drove this this prior study that we've been working on for about 3 years now was, is climate also a factor? And so, long story short, some of the preliminary analysis of the data that was collected for that work last year, in fact, has shown that communities in the Marshall Islands aren't necessarily saying, yeah, we're moving because the sea levels are rising, or, you know, we've got to get out of here because we don't have, you know, healthy crops growing anymore because of saltwater inundation, things like that. But when people have left and they've settled in places like Hawaii, those people who were interviewed say, well, now we're here and then we're talking to our family and our friends at home and we're not really sure if we want to go back. Because, you know, the ocean is crashing at our doorstep, basically.
I know that there is also concern about the drinking water.
Mm-hmm. Right. So water resources are very limited in atoll communities like the Marshall Islands. The entire archipelago is made up of 29 coral atolls, which are really low in elevation. I mean, maybe a few feet above sea level. And that includes Majuro, which is the capital of the Marshall Islands. And it's where about 50% of the 53,000 inhabitants live. And so that's a lot of water demand for very, very limited resources. The sort of the freshwater lens, which is what we call the big pool of potable drinking water that comes from rain, is extremely thin. And it's, you know, becoming increasingly encroached upon by salt water as sea levels rise. And during times of drought, the already limited water resources become even more constrained. And that's when we see a lot of disease outbreaks.
Right, so there are all these different stressors that are happening or they're playing into what's going on in the environment and then also in just people's lives and their health.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's just kind of map out where are a lot of folks migrating to?
So a lot of the Marshall Islanders, because of the Compact of Free Association, many of them, if they live on the outer atolls, first they might move from an outer atoll, which may have extremely limited resources, to a place like Majuro to pursue, you know, educational opportunities, new jobs, and perhaps better health care as well. And then from Majuro, that seems to be kind of the jumping off point to go to a place like the United States, where, again, they can move freely. They can work, they can go to school, and they can receive health care, et cetera. So a lot of the people who are leaving the Marshall Islands are going to places in the United States where they already have friends and family. One of the big locations for that is the Tyson Chicken Factory in Arkansas, which might sound kind of surprising, but again, if you think about it, you know, if you're looking for a place where you know you can get a job and you have family members who are saying, hey, come out here, you know, this is where this is where it is right now. It makes it an easier decision for you to go.
Yeah, it's a little cold, but
right. Yeah, it's a big climate shift there. But we're also finding the largest populations of Marshallese are coming to the state of Hawaii, in part because it's closer to home. But there's also an established community of Marshall Islanders already living in the state. And then there are other pretty substantial populations in the Pacific Northwest, so in Washington State and in Oregon. And all told, I believe the numbers are somewhere in the 20,000s of Marshall Islanders who are not living in the country. And when you consider that the whole population of the country is 53,000 people,
wow,
that's a huge number of migrants.
So let's talk, too, about the health part of this study, because we often hear that, diabetes is an issue, and I believe it's tuberculosis.
Right. So when we conducted the initial survey of households in the Marshall Islands, as well as people who had migrated, some of the top reasons for migrating included health impacts. And in fact, for most of the households in the Marshall Islands, when we were asking people if they were thinking about leaving, their number one reason for talking about leaving was health. And getting into the nitty-gritty of what that might have to do with climate change is trickier. There are very direct impacts on health as a result of climate change. For example, you know, a terrible extreme event that could cause injury or a mental health problem, for example. And then there are a lot of indirect impacts. So I mentioned drier weather and drought, which is a common occurrence in the Marshall Islands, especially during El Nino years. What happens, and if you imagine someone cutting off your tap at home, what's the first thing that you stop doing? You probably stop washing your hands. And so those kind of very small but important steps that people take to protect their health become exacerbated during times of climate stress. And so what we're seeing definitely are these patterns of people kind of moving around, looking for better health care, looking for healthier living conditions. And we're just wondering, you know, is there a direct link there to changes in climate? And if so, and even if there's not, you know, how can we establish kind of a win-win situation with the healthcare professionals in the Marshall Islands so that they can better anticipate changes in climate or extreme events such as drought, to be prepared for those before they happen? There's a constellation of aid organizations, the Red Cross, AusAid, for example, in New Zealand, and the U.S. military as well, who come in times of disasters and, you know, provide very, you know, basic things like water and sanitation kits. They provide desalinization, basically tanks that are portable and that can go around to the different atolls. And so it's been a really interesting project as we've spun it up, because what we're trying to do is to help better coordinate those aid institutions and kind of provide relief before the fact, as opposed to waiting until the event has already occurred. So this particular aspect of the study is going to be looking at healthcare professionals in the Marshall Islands, finding out what climate information they already have access to and how they could better use what's available. There's a Marshall Islands climate dashboard that's already out. It's online. It can give you up to 6 months of an outlook in terms of, you know, are you anticipating a dry event or anticipating very heavy rainfall? But when we've talked with health professionals just as scoping for the project, we found that, you know, sure, they know that that stuff is out there, but they don't know where to find it. You know, they're not in touch with their National Weather Service offices. And it's perfectly understandable. These health professionals are very overtaxed. There are not very many of them in the Marshall Islands. And it's just a matter of hoping that we can provide better coordination in that, you know, in that arena, in the Marshall Islands. And then similarly here in Hawaii, because we're seeing so many people coming from the Marshall Islands, you know, this is kind of the first place that they go when they leave, there may be unusual or atypical health factors that the communities here in Hawaii are dealing with. And like most other places, you know, if you arrive and you're sick and you're not sure where to go to get healthcare, you're going to ask your friends and family members. And so they tend to congregate in certain community centers and see the trusted doctors that their family and friends have seen before. And so, again, it presents us with an opportunity to say, okay, you know, we're seeing people, you know, migrating because of this constellation of factors. How can we, you know, better inform you as providers to prepare for influxes of people coming potentially as a result of changes in climate?
Right, and you'll be focusing primarily on the community here in Hawaii?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, and then so how far does this take you? How many years?
It's a 2-year project, and what we're really hoping will come out of this, in addition to you know, providing better sources of information and linking up some of these groups that may not already be connected, such as the climate and weather forecasting services and healthcare policymakers and practitioners. Ideally, in terms of interventions, a lot of the U.S. affiliated independent nations are looking at pursuing green climate fund opportunities, which, you know, is on the order of millions of dollars and can be used for things like infrastructure development, which is something that this project, you know, it's out of the scope of this project, which is primarily research, but things like these types of research projects can really help inform and address the needs that could go into a bigger project proposal.
That was Laura Brewington, a researcher, talking about migration and health as it relates to climate change in the Pacific, particularly in the Marshall Islands. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today, we're considering a general rule in Hawaiian law that is still in practice today. It originated in 1797 as a decree by King Kamehameha I. It's enshrined in the state constitution, Article 9, Section 10, and has become a model for today's human rights law regarding the treatment of civilians. King Kamehameha enacted the law after a run-in with a local Puna civilian. While chasing two fishermen, King Kamehameha caught his leg in a patch of reef. One of the men took this opportunity to hit the king on the head with a paddle. Eventually, Kamehameha was dislodged from the reef, and years later, the fisherman was located and brought before him. Instead of what some thought would be a death sentence, Kamehameha ruled the fisherman was simply protecting his land and his family. Our question for today, according to what law was this possible? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island, presenting Sudan-born singer-songwriter Alsara and her band The Nubatones, performing East African retro-pop music this Friday. KahiluTheater.org.
Joining us this morning in studio is HPR's Ku'uwehi Hirishi to talk about the art of weaving.
That's right. Good morning, Catherine. I recently got the opportunity to check out this art of weaving that's specific to the Marshall Islands. So across the Pacific Islands, we have pandanus weaving, what we know here in Hawaii as lohala weaving. But in the Marshalls, they have this particular tradition called jakied, and it's finely woven lohala clothing mats. So women would actually traditionally wear skirts made of lohala, and we really don't see that in other cultures across the Pacific. So it was really interesting to see. The even more interesting thing was that this tradition had sort of it almost died out. Maybe in the early 2000s, they started to make a comeback. So, and it's interesting because the Bishop Museum was actually where they uncovered 50 of these jakied mats.
Wow.
In the repository, and the folks in the Marshall Islands, women who were still around who had a hint of what jakied was, they were stunned because they didn't realize that this was a tradition that was so prolific, because since a little bit before World War II, traditional clothing kind of went out of use, and so the tradition itself also went away because they didn't need it because they were using Western clothing. So I got a chance to see some of these mats and speak to Marcus Hanalei-Maizan, the cultural advisor over at the Bishop Museum, about, so at the time when they found those 50 finely woven mats, there were four known Marshallese women who were who knew the tradition, who actually learned the tradition, and that was rare. But he tells us the story of why those four women knew it.
They only knew how to weave it because they were children during World War II. And during World War II, because of the, you know, the war happening in the Pacific, a lot of the Western commodities were being restricted because of the war effort. So they had to revert back to their traditional clothing. So that's when, so they went back and started to weave their clothes again. And these four women were around at that time when that need was still around. So they actually were taught by their mothers how to weave these traditional pieces.
So these four women were sort of the masters that were called upon to bring this tradition back. Folks over at the University of the South Pacific started a program called the Marshallese Weaving Cultural Restoration Project to start an apprenticeship to get these women paired with Marshallese women, young Marshallese women, and kind of bring it back. So right now, it's been 12 years since they started doing that. They've got about 24, so a half a dozen or two dozen active weavers of Jacquied in the Marshall Islands across all atolls, and then they've probably had 200 or so young women go through the program. So this tradition, they're seeing more and more of it, and it's really a nice sight to see. So they have an annual gathering every year of all the weavers, and they usually have it in the back in the Marshalls. But Bishop Museum will send one of their, you know, one of the Jacquied from their collection, send it over for an exhibition, and then the weavers get to auction off their items.
It must have been just fabulous for Hanalei, because for folks who don't know, Marcus Marzan is a master weaver himself, and
yes,
just very fine pieces of art, incredible. He showed in Paris this summer.
That's
and
right.
He was also part of that fashion show that...
Mali Arts Fashion
yes.
Show. Yeah,
fabulous.
He's a fiber art specialist, so I was glad to have him. You know, he just got back from Rapa Nui opening up that sister exhibit for the Bishop Museum's exhibit. So it was nice to catch him and sort of get his nuggets of knowledge. But this annual gathering had happened for the last 12 years in the Marshall Islands. First year, Bishop Museum hosted this year. So five of the weavers who had participated in the annual program flew up from the Marshall Islands to showcase their work and also to auction off their work. So I got to speak to Irene Tafaki, Dr. Irene Tafaki over from the University of the South Pacific in the Marshall Islands. She sort of spearheaded this cultural restoration program in the Marshalls, and she was here bringing her weavers and talking about this annual gathering.
Well, it's an opportunity, I think, for the Hawaii community to see the cultural and creative genius of many of the Marshallese women. This is an opportunity for them for economic empowerment, to see that their art is valued by other people and purchased by others.
It really was economic empowerment. So I went, and these were all on auction. There were about 30 mats made, woven by weavers in this program, and all of on average they'll go for $300 a piece, but at most $750, which is a lot for these folks from these small atolls in the Marshall Islands. I think total in the last 12 or in the last 11 years, this program through this auction has fundraised around $89,000-$90,000, and that goes straight back to the weavers and not
great.
To any. Yeah, it's so it has become sort of that economic empowerment message, as Dr. Irene Tarpaki said. I did get a chance to find one of these weavers, Marshallese weaver, Jawin Jerry Lung. She's from the island of Ebon in the Marshall Islands. She flew up along with the mayor of that island, and she had pieces in this auction. So I talked to her about what inspired her. So she's right here talking about how she was saying that her inspiration came from the pride that she feels for her island, for her home island, and being able to practice the traditions of her grandmother. So her grandmother was a weaver herself, but she did not have as much exposure to that tradition as she would have if the tradition had continued. But through this program, she's been able to take that on. She was, thank goodness, I don't speak Marshallese, so I had her, the mayor of Ebon, Ione de Broom, with her, translating for me. And I spoke to her about what this means for their entire island and for many of the Marshallese communities.
She's very young, and there's only, this is like, I'm so happy that the USB was able to revive this, because this is an old traditional method. It's rarely seen. So I'm glad that she's here and she can go back and promote with other girls.
So on top of the fact that this tradition is making a comeback, that economic component is actually something that's really motivating a lot of these weavers.
Well, that's terrific, because I know they do have a growing population here, a growing community here in the islands.
That's right. So I know personally over on the Big Island in Ocean View, a lot of the Micronesian community there are from the Marshalls. Big population there. I spoke to Tavaki about working with the local communities, because that's even, you know, the Micronesian diaspora here in Hawaii are even more isolated from their cultural traditions. So hopefully that might spill over here to Hawaii. They have collected over the last 130 years so many items that when put on display, I think the communities that are still around or that come through the museum are really, you know,
very appreciative. Yeah,
exactly.
So yeah, terrific for Bishop Museum for having that collection to share and to keep this thread going.
Exactly. I think if it wasn't for those 50 mats that were found at the Bishop Museum, honestly, it would have taken a lot more a longer time for the Marshallese to figure out that this was in fact something that was really important to their kupuna.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes, thanks, Catherine.
That was Kuʻuwehi Hiraishi, and for all her stories, you can log on to hawaiipublicradio.org. Now time for our reality check, featuring our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Halloween may be over, but today we're talking bats, in particular the hoary bat. The Opeopea happens to be our state mammal. Special correspondent Kirsten Downey joins us this morning. Hi there.
Aloha, Kathy.
So what can you tell us about our hoary bat?
Well, it is an indigenous species of Hawaii. It's one of the few species of animals that was here many centuries before man and has managed to survive. It's an endangered species also. This Opeopea bat is also really interesting because it's sacred in Hawaiian culture. Like the shark and like the lizard, it's a creature that has that is viewed both affectionately and also with some degree of particular respect.
Now, I understand that, you know, this has been kind of a sensitive issue for the folks, for the community up on the North Shore, where we've got a lot of these wind turbines operating.
Right. People on the North Shore have always been very supportive of clean energy and were initially very supportive of the windmills that were built in 2016 in the area between Haliva Town and Waimea Valley. They knew that some birds and bats would be killed by the spinning blades of the turbine. They just didn't know that so many bats pets in particular, this endangered species, would be killed. In the past 6 years, at least 83 bats have been killed. And Kauai Aloha Wind Farm has now come back to the state and is asking for permission to kill up to 265 within the next 20 years.
Right, and I'm sure
they would need permission to do that, yes.
And that doesn't sit well, I'm sure, with some folks in the community.
Well, it's one of those really terrible dichotomies that pits clean energy against a beloved animal species that's endangered.
Right, and I understand that the company that is doing Kauai Aloha Wind Farm, that they have just made a generous donation to protect, I think, the hoary bat habitat somewhere else in central Oahu.
Yes, Governor David Ige just recently announced an expansion and that the state was able to move forward with the purchase of Helemano Wilderness Recreation Area, which is near Wahiawa. And part of the money they've gotten is from Kaiwaloa Wind Farm, which is owned by a New York investment firm. They gave $2.75 million towards the purchase of this site, which, you know, many environmentalists are applauding. But other people are wondering that the money's already been given. It seems like the fix is already in and that the state isn't really deliberating over whether they're going to give permission to the wind farm to kill more bats.
Right. And I know from the company's point of view that, you know, there's a trade-off here. They hadn't anticipated killing so many bats so quickly. At the same time, they're saying, what are our options when it comes to green energy if we want to meet those goals of getting weaned off of oil?
Exactly. They, of course, believe fervently that, you know, wind energy is a cleaner form of energy than fossil fuels. Hawaii is very eager to, you know, we're very eager to wean ourselves off fossil fuels as much as possible. So there's a very good reason to have some wind farms. They knew that some birds would be killed. They just didn't know that this many bats would be killed. And one of the things that's really challenging about this is we don't even know very much about this tiny little bat. It's about, when it's flying and its wingspan is extended, it's about a foot wide, and it weighs less than an ounce. They're very hard to see. Some people have never seen them. And we thought there were very few of them. It's possible there are more than we thought there were, but nobody really knows.
I remember when we were going through the legislature and they were trying to designate this bat as our state mammal, there was a lot of talk about that. And no one knew a lot about the species.
And to a lot of people on the North Shore, and particularly Hawaiians, it's incomprehensible that the state would be considering killing off such a special animal.
Right, and they've extended the time for public input, right?
Yeah, that's right. They thought they would be closing up public comment by the end of this year. But in fact, they've extended the comment period until February 21st. And people who are concerned about this can write to the State Department of Land and Natural Resources to give their own thoughts.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Kirsten.
Thank you.
That was Special Correspondent Kirsten Downey with today's Reality Check. To read her story, visit civilbeat.org.
Aloha, this is Jose Fajardo, President and General Manager of Hawaii Public Radio, personally inviting you to nominate yourself or someone else to join HPR's Community Advisory Board. The contributions of this advisory board in the last 2 years have been so important. We're looking for perspectives from around the state, especially from neighbor islands. Apply at hawaiipublicradio.org. Deadline is December 14th, so hurry and mahalo.
We talked with the giant in the world of surf media last week. Jim Kempton was the longtime editor of Surfer Magazine, and although he no longer works there, he has continued his focus on surf media and culture. At the California Surf Museum, Jim curated an exhibit highlighting the role of surfing in the Vietnam War and the men who fought there. He spoke about it with HPR's Ryan Finnerty.
At the California Surf Museum, where I am the president, I curated an exhibit regarding surfing during the Vietnam War and the healing power of wave riding. So we called it China Beach because that was the main R&R spot that surfers went, that Marines went to, military guys went to for rest and recuperation between, you know, battle zones. And the really interesting thing about it is that one, you know, Vietnam had a very young group of servicemen. The average age was 19, and to put that in perspective, the average age in World War II was 24. So much younger guys, a disproportionate number of those people came from California and came from surfing, because surfers at that time were generally, you know, young, unemployed, fit. They passed, you know, they passed the exams, and very few of them were 4F, and they also made really great great soldiers in a way, because they were so used to reading the elements and being out in the elements and understanding the changing, the constant changing environment that's in that. So there were a lot of surfers that went to Vietnam, and they were dying to go surfing. Many of them ended up in China Beach either from being wounded during a firefight, or because they, you know, they were out for more than 6 months, which they'd recognized was about all you could take in a combat zone. Without getting PTSD, and some of them already had it. But we interviewed about 200 vets, and it was just fascinating to hear their stories, both about before they went and their surfing during the Vietnam War, and then, you know, the effects afterwards. Because interestingly enough, surfing went through an enormous change during the period that the Vietnam War was going on. And it went from longboards to shortboards, from short hair to long hair, from very disciplined kind of 50s style to, you know, radical 60s style. And many of the guys that went in early were completely taken aback when they arrived back in California after their tour of duty, and were kind of lost. They didn't know what to do. And of course, you know, the Vietnam veterans were not treated well, like they have been respected today. Because of the controversial nature of the war, and they, so many of them really suffered through that, and many of them, of course, suffered during the war, because it was a very brutal war in which there were a lot of civilian casualties, and they were fought in civilian areas. So it was extremely stressful, and a lot of the guys had issues when they got back. And over that entire time that we were talking with these guys, the one thing that came through over and over again from all of them was just how surfing had been such an important part of them healing, either while they were there, you know, by being able to take away their, you know, their stress, or when they got back, by giving them a focus and a meaning to their life again.
And we've seen now where surfing is being used to treat PTSD in veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
It's really true. The healing power of wave riding, which is the second half of the title of it, is something that now has been a proven factor, that there's something about the ocean and its tranquility, and yet it's also its power that people can really appreciate, and that does something to the human psyche that is positive.
You mentioned that surfing underwent a transformation around the same time as the Vietnam War. And that's sort of the stereotype of the surfer from that era, is long hair, counterculture, anti-war, maybe a draft dodger even. Do you think, is that a chicken and the egg situation? Was it these guys who came back from Vietnam who were surfers that sort of seeded that culture, or did it evolve and did the times shape the surf culture?
Well, I think the times shaped the surf culture in the sense that this was not something that was planned. Shortboards were just sort of discovered and invented, and they worked so well. And the change was really rapid. So back in those days, you know, in the 60s, it was rare that something would completely revolutionize in as short a time as 4 years. And that was really pretty much what happened. So if you went to Vietnam in 65 and you came back in 69, in 69, there were no longboards. Everybody had a shortboard. And if you'd been riding a longboard during that era in 65, you really didn't know what was going on with it, and you had to readjust. The same way with all the cultural elements, you know, of fashion and dress and speech and music, you know, just exploded during that time. But Vietnam was also a war, one of the first wars where, you know, America brought its culture to the war zone. So most of these guys were able to listen to the music. They were able to write home quickly. They were able to get on the phone and talk to their loved ones. They were able to see and hear what was going on at home. And that brought the changes in American culture a lot closer to Vietnam. And then, of course, all the hundreds of thousands of guys who were coming that were younger, also affected the whole program there. And of course, the anti-war movement also very much affected the war movement.
And now we've kind of come full circle where surfers are sort of back to being the very disciplined, healthy, fit, the kind of people that, you know, as you mentioned, would make good soldiers. And you were kind of describing that earlier. And why do you think that is? What was it about surfers in those times that made for good soldiers, good fighters?
You know, I mean, the first thing, of course, is fitness. I mean, if you're out surfing 3-4 hours a day or more, you are in great shape. And very few sports can make you all round that way. You know, it's everything from doing burpees 100 times when you jump up on your board to paddling, you know, probably several miles in a surf session to bending, stretching, being knocked off, being knocked down. All of the kinds of things that might be part of martial arts or might be part of tennis, might be part of even football. And so surfers were used to that. They were also really used to reading the environment. So knowing what the swell was doing, knowing what the wind was doing, knowing the direction of the sun and of the light and where it was going to be, all those things are just as important if you are in a war zone as if you're in a competitive arena out in the waves.
And so if the museum is in California, but for anyone listening here in Hawaii who can't make it over, can we view the exhibit online?
You can go online to californiasurfmuseum.org, and you can see all the exhibits and all the past exhibits as well. So you get a really good view of all of that. It's a really great museum. It's been in business for 30 years, 35 years now almost. And 7 days a week, if you're ever over there, it's a great place to come and visit.
That was Jim Kempton, president of the California Surf Museum. He was talking about the museum's current exhibit, China Beach, Surfers, the Vietnam War, and the Healing Power of Wave Riding. And again, if you can't make it to the museum in Oceanside, California, you can see the exhibit online. We will have a link posted on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and also what we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, turning to the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips and welcoming him back right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Venus in the eastern sky before dawn and Mars in the western sky after sunset. Both planets are bright and should be easy to spot. The moon this week is waxing, bringing a bright presence to the night sky as the week goes on.
And speaking of planet spotting, I understand there is a new telescope which is engaged in just such an activity.
There is. Far back in time and space here on Stargazer, we spoke about a brand new planet-hunting telescope that was being constructed in Chile. Its name is Speculos, Planets Eclipsing Ultra-Cool Stars. Well, Speculos has just seen first light, which is what we astronomers say when a telescope has opened its eyes to the heavens for the first time. In just a few weeks, this brand new planet hunter will begin looking for new worlds out there in the Milky Way galaxy.
And when you say cool stars, I don't think you're saying that kind of like, man, that's a cool star. What is that exactly?
it's a little different. We're actually referring to temperature. An ultra-cool star is still very hot by human standards, but compared to populations of other stars in the galaxy, such as blue giants or even our own sun, they can appear relatively cool. And because they are cool, they are almost always dwarf stars as well, so much smaller and less massive than our own sun.
And now, is this going to be a large telescope, kind of like the TMT, or is this an entirely different sort of deal?
Well, Speculus is actually made of four telescopes. Each one is about a meter in diameter, and they work together to peer into the depths of the galaxy to observe these small, cool dwarfs. And basically, they're looking for tiny fluctuations in light caused by an orbiting planet, something we call transit photometry.
Are those four devices near each other, or are they spread out over a large geographic area?
They are all on the same site, merely meters away from each other.
That'll keep maintenance costs down, won't it?
Absolutely. Not far to travel if you have to fix one.
And so Speculus will be looking at the brown dwarfs as well as these ultra-cool dwarfs, right?
Yes, that's one of the mysteries that Speculus is going to be investigating is, do brown dwarfs have families of planets all of their own? Because brown dwarfs aren't stars. They're kind of between a gas giant and a star. So they're kind of a weird object.
Well, thankfully, we have you to sort all of this out for us, Christopher.
You are most welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary and more than 29 years of support for Honolulu Sunrise Rotary. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, FerraroChoi.com.
Today on the Backyard Quiz, we asked about a law enacted by King Kamehameha I in 1797. It was the law of the splintered paddle. The name stems from these circumstances. While fighting in Puna, the king was chasing two fishermen when his foot got stuck in a patch of reef. One of the fishermen took the opportunity to strike Kamehameha over his head with a paddle, which broke in pieces. Years later, the man was found and brought to Kamehameha for judgment. But rather than sentence the man to death, he declared the fisherman was simply protecting his land and his family, and he set the man free. The king did not invent the law, but he expressed the concepts held for many generations. And the law is still recognized today and is written into our Hawaii State Constitution, Article 9, Section 10. And congratulations to Brian from Honolulu. You got it right. The law of the splintered paddle. That's our quiz for today, and if you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ballet Hawaii, presenting The Nutcracker, set in the 1858 Kingdom of Hawaii, this Friday through Sunday at the Blaisdell. Tickets at ballethawaii.org or ticketmaster.com.
Let there be light. Candlelight, that is. And that's what will happen this Friday at the Mission Houses Museum. Local actor Will Ha'o sat down with us to talk about the plan to resurrect the tea and tour by candlelight at what is the oldest home in Honolulu. It's a little holiday twist on the museum's Pupu Theater program.
It'll be in the oldest still standing house in Hawaii. And they'll be touring the house, and then we're going to have actors portraying 19th century characters telling their stories, different parts of the hale, the house. And we're going to have food afterwards, and we're going to have fellowship, you know. So that's the event.
It's always fun when you see history come to life. And yeah. You folks do a wonderful Pupu Theater program right. Throughout the year.
Yeah, it's one of our signature programs, very successful. And we sell out every year. So we have like 50 characters now. And so you'll see four of them in period costume and just sharing their life stories and how, you know, like you have your own story, I have my own story. And that's what makes each and every one of us special, yeah? And we are part of this fabric, this wonderful tapestry called Hawaiʻi, you know, so.
Well, share with us, who are the characters that will come to life that night?
Okay, William Kanui is, I will read you a little part of his character. You want me to do that?
Okay, sure.
Okay. When I was 13, I thought something was missing in my life. Adventure. By 1809, Waimea Harbor was filled with American ships looking for sandalwood. My brother and I decided we'd take advantage of new opportunities. So, one day, we boarded the brig Elizabeth bound for America. What sights we saw! Alaska, China, Africa! We eventually arrived in Boston. We spent years working farms or as domestic servants, and when war came to the United States, we signed on as privateers to fight the British and the Tripoli pirates. Now, we each would have been killed many times over had we not been together. After the war, we headed to New York City to find work. On this journey, my brother took ill. We rested in Providence, Rhode Island. I sat by his bedside for weeks, desperately praying to the gods to save him. Perhaps had I known of the one true God then, maybe things would have been different. He passed, leaving me alone in a strange land. So he was on the first ship that came with Reverend Bingham, and he was sent to work with King Liholiho. Christmas in Hawaii. The first Christmas revelers to come to the islands were the European sailors and traders in the 1700s. Aboard ships and on land, they invited Hawaiian chiefs to celebrate the holiday with them. In George Dixon's log, he writes, "This being Christmas, we spent our time as agreeably and with plenty as good cheer as we could procure, such as roast pig and sea pie." Then in the 1820s, the Protestant missionaries came by. And then and decades after that, when America and Hawaii were culturally diverse, Christmas was shared into everybody's household. And in Hawaii, the first Christmas tree in Hawaii Kingdom was enjoyed in 1858 at a party hosted by Mrs. John Dominus, the future Queen Liliuokalani's mother-in-law at Washington Place. This party became an annual tradition for years to come. 1862, the Hawaiian government issued order that Christmas Day be a public holiday and that all public offices were to be closed.
Oh, there you go. So it's really neat, though, to kind of trace that back and showcase how that holiday came to be.
Yeah, and then I think over 10 years ago, we used to do this candlelight Christmas at mission houses, so we're bringing it back because people have enjoyed it so much and missed it. So it's a remnant of our candlelight Christmas of the past, the program that many people remember as their favorite. And we're putting a new twist on it that takes advantage of our current signature program, Cemetery Pupu Theater.
That's terrific.
I mean, want to know what you're going to eat?
Sure. Oh, you have the whole menu, do you? You're going to make us hungry.
Okay, we will be serving a variety of teas, including hot toddies, savory bites. We will have chicken curry tea sandwiches, cucumber tea sandwiches, as well as quiches and goat cheese, thyme biscuits, fresh fruit scones with lily koi butter.
I mean, these are things that the families there brought out during the holidays.
Yeah, it's reminiscent, yeah. You know, it's unique because you're going to go back in time, you know. What's great about it is that afterwards, you know, people get into discussions, and one thing leads to the next. Somebody knows something that somebody else didn't know back then. It triggers, you know, memory. I've been away for 25 years in New York City, performing there, and instead of coming back for like this last 10 years, it's been so special for me because I forgot a lot of my history being away so long. And so each time we do a new New Year Cemetery Pupu Theater, I'm astounded by our rich history.
No. Now, in your program this past year, I know you folks have featured a number of things, and one of them was Henry O. Pukuhi'a.
Yes.
You were celebrating his life.
Right.
Talk about that.
Well, we that celebrate the bicentennial, Moses Goods wrote and performs his one-act play. We initially saw it at Mission House Museum, and he's taken it on tour. And so in celebration with New England, different churches and whatnot, he'll be performing in New England.
So do we know when?
I think it's the latter part of September 2019.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah. And so we're lining, you know, the schedule is being set as we talk.
Right, because I remember when they brought Henry O. Pukuhi'a's remains to Kahikolo Church, and I was there when that happened, and then also happened to run into the kahu who was able to preside at the memorial and the prayer and the send-off in Cornwall when they were bringing Henry home to Hawaii.
Right. That's where the character that I just read, William Kanui, the reason he became a Christian was because of Henry O. Pukuhi'a. he saw that this young Hawaiian man was distraught, lonely by himself, and took him in and shared his, you know, Christianity with him and whatnot. And so, and Henry died, you know, soon after. And so it was funny that, you know, the person he saved came on the first ship back with the missionaries.
Right, and then yeah. You get to portray him at this event.
Yes, and he's buried right across the street, Kauai Church. Only two Hawaiians buried in the missionary section. So he's become a friend of mine.
It's really an opportunity to reflect on that time and the holidays in that setting. It's kind of a really powerful thing because you get connected, you know, to the time that way.
And what people don't know is that Queen Ka'ahumanu used to frequent the mission houses a lot. And she'd take her naps there.
I love that.
Yeah. In fact, I think one story is that she would be there so often that sometimes they would turn off the candles, take down the candles so nobody was home. So, you know, it's a funny story. No, so it's just a rich history. When you come, there's something so beautifully calm and serene when you come into the grounds of the mission, Hawaiian mission houses. And I love it. I mean, we do summer shows there as well, outdoor stage. We have the Hawaiian concerts 4 times a year. So there's a lot of activity in that little area of downtown.
Right. So if you want to join in the festivities there at the Mission House Museum, you've got to hurry up because I'm sure these tickets are going to get snatched up.
Yes. It's December 14th, and the first tour is at 6:15, and there's 5 tours. So 6:15, 6:30, 6:45, 7:15. And it's like 10 people per tour. So just call the Mission House. Call the Mission Houses at 447-3926, or you can go on the website, missionhouses.org.
That was Will Howe talking about the holiday tea and tours by candlelight at the Mission Houses Museum and Archives this Friday. Have to go, but up tomorrow, Shuffleboard Pilots, the history of the woman's air raid defense in Hawaii. We would like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them on the Conversation page on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.